This is the History of the World podcast with me, Chris Hasler. Now, of course, last week we had a special episode. We did something that we've never done before, and we ventured off the beaten track and we rewarded one of our patrons with a special episode on the House of Vasa, the Royal House of Vasa, which ruled over Sweden and Poland, Lithuania. If you haven't listened to it, please do go back and listen to it. And if you did listen to it, I'd love to know what you thought of it, whether you thought it was a good thing to do, considering that we're putting off our journey into ancient Rome. Well, this week we've got another special episode, and it's for one of our great patrons who's really helped support the podcast. It's the man who creates all the wonderful videos on YouTube for the History of the World podcast. It's the man behind the Study of Antiquity and the Middle Ages, the channel on YouTube, and it's the man himself, Nick Barksdale. And for him, this week, we're going to be talking about the Picts. Of the Picts is a mysterious story, and one that exists strictly in the first millennium, and one that exists in the modern country of Scotland. The Pictish people were Celtic in origin. The Celts are thought to have originated in Central Europe during the second millennium BCE, and over the course of the next 1,000 years, the Celts would spread out across the whole of Central Europe, from the modern country of Portugal in the west all the way to the modern country of Bulgaria in the east. As we discovered during our Ancient Greece series, a faction of Gallic Celts migrated into Anatolia and established a cultural centre called Galatia. But also we know that the Celts crossed the English Channel and occupied both Britain and Ireland. It would only be the expansion of the Empire of the Romans that would take most of the lands back from Celtic governance and leave them in a small area of northwest Europe, mainly the British Isles. With the Celtic peoples covering such an expansive area over such a long amount of time, the Celtic tribes of Europe would become more distinguished from each other over time. So when the Romans invaded Britain, they would have already been familiar with the Celtic peoples, but none quite like the ones that they encountered in Britain. Those scholars who have studied Celtic cultures very closely can even distinguish between the different Celtic tribes of the British Isles. Through linguistics, they can determine that the Celtic languages are Indo-European in origin, and that's because of the way that they pronounced particular consonant sounds. There were two groups of Celtic languages. One group of Celtic languages were called P-Celtic and the other Q-Celtic. The Celts who lived in the north of Britain favoured using the Q sound instead of the P sound on particular words, and therefore their languages are called Q-Celtic. The distinguishing things about the Celtic people of the British Isles was the fact that they painted their faces and bodies with dyes. Their clothes and hair were dyed in bright colours, and they referred to themselves as the Painted People. Now, this is interesting because of the rather more well-known story of how the Picts got their name. It's because of the Romans. The Romans came across these painted people and called them the Picti. Picti has the same etymological root as the word picture, which is derived from the Latin word for painting. This is interesting because of where we believe the etymological origin of the name Britain comes from. The Romans called the British island Britannia, believed to have originated from the Celtic word Britanni. That could have been the Celtic way to describe themselves as the painted ones. If the original P-Celtic word was Pruinia, then the original Q-Celtic word was Cruinia, and Cruinia was supposedly the name of the first Pictish king. The Picts, as the Romans called them, are the people described as occupying lands where the Romans had previously described as being the home of the Caledoni people, which is really in the northern portion of Great Britain. And so the story of the Picts as a distinct group of the Celtic residents of Britannia is the story of the inhabitants of the modern country of Scotland. Agricola. Gnaeus Julius Agricola was born in Gallia Narbonensis, which is in the modern country of France, in the year 40. And he would become an important official of the Roman Empire. Upon coming of age, he would be sent to Britain as a military official to learn more. So throughout his career, he would stay close to British politics, and he would come and go throughout his life. In the year 79, Agricola would embark on a campaign of northern Britain. It was a very highly considered campaign, with roads being laid down and forts being built. The Pictish peoples would have surely been among the Caledonian Confederacy reported to have opposed the Romans under Agricola at the Battle of Mons Graupius, in which the Romans scored a big victory. But with reports of the Caledonians fleeing into the woods and disappearing from the Roman radar, the Romans would have to just be satisfied with the military victory. The rugged terrain of Scotland just wasn't a place favourable for open battlefield conflict, and so eliminating the Caledonians completely was going to be virtually impossible. The lowlands of modern Scotland were secured by the Romans under Agricola, and the Pictish peoples would have been pushed further north into the highlands of Caledonia. Agricola's campaigns were deemed to be successful, and he would be recalled in the year 85 and seemed to go into a condition of retirement, although he would end up dying at the young age of 53 in the year 93. Septimius Severus. We know that throughout the 2nd century that the Romans would be in conflict with those tribal societies of northern Britain, and the legacy of these conflicts were preserved by the construction of Hadrian's Wall and the Antonine Wall, which were both designed to represent the northernmost border of the Roman Empire and a place by which they could look north and subdue the British tribes. However, when Septimius Severus became the Roman Emperor, he decided that Caledonia should be conquered, and he would prepare an army of 40,000 people to get the job done. Both Hadrian's Wall and the Antonine Wall were refortified before Severus would endeavour to go one step further than Agricola and completely conquer the island. And although he was the emperor, he would be doing it in person. The Romans marched into the Caledonian lands with purpose, and although it was originally thought that the Roman fort of Carpo was built during this period, the beginning of the 3rd century, it is now actually thought that Carpo was originally a 2nd century construction that Severus recommissioned and improved. Carpo has been identified as a Pictish word, and the Picts are identified as having their own Pictish language, which is most likely a Brythonic language, which is a form of Celtic. So Severus was able to establish himself as a viable threat to the modern Scottish lands, possibly on the verge of subjugating these lands of northern Britain in the same way as they did to the modern English and Welsh lands. However, there were rebellions among the natives before Severus would have to return south to the city of Eboracum, the modern city of York, due to illness. Severus actually died from this illness in 211, and his sons, who had accompanied him, were far more interested in going back to Rome to compete for the Roman throne than they were in fighting Caledonians. The end of the Romans. The Celtic peoples of the British Isles did nothing to document their history, and so we have to rely on the Romans to tell us anything about these indigenous people. The longer that the Romans occupied Great Britain, the more that they understood the people of Great Britain. By the 4th century BCE, the Celtic Britons, who lived alongside the border of Roman Britain, had got somewhat used to living on a Roman border, close to Roman people, because it is all that they ever knew in their own lifetimes. To them, having Roman neighbours was quite normal. However, in the far north of the island were Celtic Britons who didn't have any real relationship with the Romans and just saw them as an aggressive threat. It seems that these were the Picts, with their distinct attitude and their distinct language. Now, we always have to be speculative about who was a Pict and whether societies were integrating into and out of Pictish ethnicity. But we believe that we can generally consider the Picts to be those societies in the far north of Scotland by this time, and that they were the ones who resisted Roman integration longer than most other Celtic societies of Great Britain. The Picts were generally much more of a concept, largely linked by a similar language, so we mustn't think of them as a nation state, but as a group of societies with cultural links, such as their language. Eumenius, the Roman scribe, referenced the Picti in his writings late in the 3rd century, and also referenced the Hiberni, who were believed to have originated in Ireland and were likely ancestral or synonymous with the Scoti, who would migrate across the Irish Sea to Scottish lands during the first millennium. These outlying Celts, who had not become accustomed to Roman presence and culture on the British Isles, appear to have frequently challenged the Romans, and the intensity and solidarity of these societies appeared to intensify during the 4th century, with repeated allied attacks from the Picti and the Scoti, allied with other Celtic Britons and Saxon pirates who had been shown an interest in the British Isles themselves. The Saxons were seafarers from Germanic lands who were raiding the lands of the North Sea and the English Channel, but they were certainly no friends of the Romans. Going into the 5th century, the Romans had to recall all of their resources to defend their continental interests. And this meant that because the north of Great Britain was pretty much on the extremities of the Roman Empire, that these lands were among the first to be abandoned. So the Roman threat to Pictish lands gradually diminished and eventually disappeared. Christianity. The Roman legacy of Britain includes the encouragement of writing, especially the recording of events, and how this could immortalise culture to inspire the culture to prosper, with those who referred to the writing as a means to understand and take pride in their own identity. It is thanks to those writings that we can even have some form of story about the Picts, as we see points of reference dotted around in first millennium British and Irish annals and chronicles. Pictish king lists exist, although many historians would suggest that the earliest records refer to mythological kings only, such as Cuidnia, mentioned as the first Pictish king earlier in the episode. Also, we find that some sources mention alternative names for particular time periods, which supports a theory of there being multiple kings for multiple tribes or societies, which further supports the notion of there not being a united Pictish nation of people, but more likely numerous Pictish societies acting as a confederation if it suited them to do so. One of the Pictish kings mentioned in the first millennium scriptures is a man called Bride. Bride was a Pictish king and likely to be of a proportion of Pictish people who ruled at the same time as other Pictish kings over other societies of Pictish peoples. Bride is believed to have received his crown in a patrilineal manner, so after the death of his father, but Bride's reign was significant because we believe that this was during a very important period of British history. Christian missionary work in the British Isles had been going on certainly during the 5th century BCE, with the work of St. Patrick being iconic of this. King Bride was alive during the lifetime of Columba. Columba was ordained in 551 and Bride became a Pictish king in 554. Bride's kingdom was based around the town of Inverness in the north of the modern country of Scotland, and Columba reached Inverness while touring the Scottish lands carrying out his missionary work. When he met Bride, he successfully converted him to Christianity, and the Pictish people of the kingdom dutifully followed their king, so the Picts were now a Christian society. From this point onwards, into the 7th century, there is a strong reference to Christian monks living among and working alongside Pictish societies peacefully. The Christian Church of Scottish lands took on a distinctly Celtic character, which distinguished it in its style. The Celtic Christian Church was a humble church where monks lived in poverty alongside their wives, which is unlike some of the chaste traditions of other Christian society monasteries. The churches and chapels were small, and the apparent absence of a modern secular society structure in Pictish lands was echoed by the church, which did not have the kind of parish structure that we may be more familiar with in more civilised Christian societies. The societies of the British Isles. The political makeup of the British Isles was ever-changing during the first millennium, and it can be difficult to distinguish societies due to the fluid movement and integration of peoples. So we have to go against our instincts to categorise everyone and everything and remember that these societies did not have a modern structure with borders and identities like the modern nations that we know today. However, through language and culture, you can describe roughly what was going on. We spoke of the pre-Celtic and Q-Celtic societies, distinguished by the diversification of the Celtic language on the British Isles, and we have identified that the Pictish peoples of the far north of Great Britain were speaking a Q-Celtic form of Celtic language, which distinguished them from the pre-Celtic speaking Brittonic people of the modern southern Scottish lands of the ancient kingdom of Strathclyde. The Picts may have spoken an earlier form of language before it was influenced by Goidelic language speaking Celtic people of Ireland, such as the Scotti, who were migrating into the Western Isles of Scotland and the western coasts of the modern country of Scotland. In the lands of the modern country of England, Germanic peoples, who are historically referred to as the Anglo-Saxons, had landed and colonised the lands and had started to spread out their range of influence. So the modern lands of Scotland were starting to become distinguishable according to the cultures that were settling the lands. So let's have a quick tour of 7th century Scotland. In the far north were the Picts, living in the lands often referred to as Pictland. The lands of the Picts could be broken down further into smaller societies, but it doesn't serve us well at this stage to try and further describe it. To the west was the kingdom of Dalriada, which covers the lands of the sea to the west of Scotland. Including coastal lands, the Western Isles, and lands in the north of Ireland, which was the home of the migrating Scotti, who are the people we just mentioned. In the lands to the southwest were the Brittonic-speaking Britons of the Kingdom of Strathclyde. And in the southeast were the people who had migrated northwards and established the Kingdom of Northumbria, inhabited by Angles. The Northumbrians were by far the most powerful of all the kingdoms, and the others were to some degree subservient to them. Now, we briefly mentioned how the Celtic Catholic Church differed in its traditions from the Roman Catholic Church, and there was a king of Northumbria called Oswiu, who famously ruled that Northumbria would honour the Roman Catholic dates for Easter over the Celtic suggestion. And this decision was made at the famed Synod of Whitby. Oswiu was quite a powerful monarch, so it was a bit of a blow when he died in 670, and he was succeeded as the King of Northumbria by his son Egfrith. It would not take long for the Picts to try their luck against the fresh king, and they invaded in 671. The Northumbrians would be equal to the threat, but this would not prevent the Picts from being a continuous pest at the Northumbrians' northern borders. The culmination of this situation was at the Battle of Dunnechtain, where the Picts, led by their king Bridei III, lured the Northumbrian army, led by King Egfrith, into a battle where the exact location remains unknown. However, we do know that the Picts scored an important victory, and King Egfrith of Northumbria was killed. Not only could the Picts now escape from the hegemony of the Northumbrians, but the kingdoms of Strathclyde and Dalriada could now escape the overbearing Northumbrians, who would not try to expand northwards again. both Pictland and Dalriada would actually follow the Northumbrian lead into the Roman Catholic traditions, leaving behind the Celtic Catholic. Annals refer to an 8th century Pictish king called Angus, who took the throne sometime at the end of the 720s or the beginning of the 730s. Angus's reign was significant because he was able to take control of the lands of Dalriada, putting the Scots of Dalriada under Pictish rule. Some claim that Angus himself had some Scottish blood, which meant that a takeover of Dalriada may have been somewhat acceptable to the Scots. But there is evidence that Dalriada is somewhat disjointed with a lack of cohesion, which Angus took advantage of, pillaging the kingdom of its wealth. Although Angus had created an understanding with the Northumbrians early in his reign, when King Edbert became the king, he was concerned with the growing power of King Angus of Pictland. Fortunately for Angus, the new frosty relationship between Pictland and Northumbria really didn't escalate much beyond cross-border raiding, which is typical behaviour of the medieval societies of northern Britain. King Angus would turn his attention to the kingdom of Strathclyde, but he would find that despite his successes in expanding the power and influence of the Picts, that Strathclyde would be able to defend themselves quite capably against Angus's aggressions. One source I read suggested that Angus was able to subjugate Strathclyde, but others suggest that this was a change in fortune for Angus. His brother was killed in battle against the Britons of Strathclyde, and King Edbert of Northumbria formed a new alliance with Angus, which may have been motivated by the strengthening of their neighbours. There is also evidence of an uprising against Angus in Dalriada. So in the final years of Angus's reign, there is still no doubt that Pictland was the dominant force of Scottish lands, and there is no doubt that Angus influenced his neighbouring kingdoms and societies. But Pictish domination did not extend much beyond his lifetime. Norsemen. When you talk about the British Isles towards the end of the first millennium, you cannot avoid talking about Norse invasions. Not only had Northumbria been subdued by its neighbours, but now it was facing invasion from the sea, and this would surely have been good for the Picts and the Scots, who would have been looking to profit from the misfortune of the Northumbrians. However, the first Viking invasion of Northumbria in 793 would have sent shockwaves throughout Great Britain, as societies would have slowly realised the sheer magnitude of the threat to everybody after the Vikings heartlessly destroyed the religious community at Lindisfarne. It was a true massacre, with the church destroyed and the residents of the monastery slaughtered. The Vikings were quick to raid and occupy the islands around northern Britain. No mercy was given to anyone, and all valuables were plundered, whether sacred or not. The Shetlands, the Orkneys, the Hebrides, the Western Isles and the Isle of Man were all taken by the Vikings, and this was not a welcome act for the Scots of Dalriada, especially when the Vikings started landing in their land of origin, Ireland. This would give them a power base in the British Isles, and the Vikings were now here to stay. All of the British kingdoms would now have the threat of the Norsemen on their doorstep. Strathclyde looked out to the Viking-occupied islands. The Scotlands of Dalriada were confined to their mainland possessions, and the Pictish kingdoms had occupied islands to the west and the north. This is what brought the Picts and the Scots into a union. The actual nature of the union remains unknown, but we can be sure that the mainland societies were very concerned about the Viking presence and knew that they would need to stick together to deal with it. Early in the 9th century, a man called Alpin was the king of Dalriada, and he consolidated the union between the Scots and the Picts by marrying a Pictish princess. They would have a son, and that son would become a major icon in Scottish history. His name was Kine, the son of Alpin. And so his name comes down to us today, somewhat anglicised, as Kenneth MacAlpin. Kine may have become the king of Dalriada in around 841 when his father Alpin died. It is possible that the Pictish throne could have been matrilineal, and that could explain how Kine would have qualified to have been the Pictish king also. There is a chronicle that describes Viking invasions of Pictland, but it suggests that it wasn't necessarily Vikings from modern Norwegian lands, but possibly Danish pirates. The chronicle describes how many Picts were slaughtered. Now, with Kine likely considering himself of Scots origin as opposed to Pictish, there is a suspicion of Kinnaeth marching from Dalriada to Pictland and taking the Pictish throne without much opposition. There is suspicion of a battle where Kinnaeth killed many Picts, but this could have just been Kinnaeth battling against local earls who were rivals for the Pictish throne. What happened next is something that puzzles historians to this very day. It seems that during the reign of Kenneth MacAlpin that the annals and chronicles fall somewhat silent about events from 844. And then when the stories re-emerge describing the later years of Kenneth's reign, there is no mention of the Picts. There is no mention of the Picts ever again. The Picts totally disappeared in the middle of the 9th century. Legacy. So what happened to the Picts? Well, in my opinion, I simply believe that they were absorbed into the kingdom of Kenneth MacAlpin, and due to the aggressions of the Vikings venturing into Caithness in the far north, those Pictish people that were left were probably squashed into the area of Murray. If Kenneth MacAlpin did kill the rival earls, then the culture of the Picts may have been compromised, as there was a Pictish aristocracy ruling over the classes of agricultural peasants and slaves. The peasants and slaves would have had little influence over their destiny, with the aristocracy put down by the Scottish king Kenneth, and so Pictish culture may have been simply diluted down to nothing and simply become part of an amalgamated kingdom of Scots and Picts, which would be the embryo of the modern country of Scotland. The mystery of the Picts is further accentuated by around 200 incised stone slabs that date between the 4th and 7th centuries and have been found in the east of Scotland, in an area undoubtedly Pictish. We described how the Picts became Christianised, and the later stones definitely relate to the Christian culture of the Picts. The earlier ones were before the Christianisation of the Picts, and these are the most mysterious. with strange imagery of humans and animals which appear to be distinct to Pictish culture, with nothing else quite like it discovered elsewhere in the British Isles. Pictish place names are very distinguishable. One of the easily recognisable place name prefixes is Pit, as in the town name Pitlochry, and it's often referenced as characteristic of Pictish town names. However, a more interesting Pictish prefix is Abba, as in the town Aberdeen. Abba means river and can be compared to the Abba used in Welsh town names such as Aberystwyth, which points towards the Celtic connection. Some historians actually believe that Pictish cultural origins predate the Celtic migration to the British Isles, but there is no strong evidence for this theory. However, if the Scots migrated over from Ireland, then the original Scottish people were the Picts, and we could have very easily have been calling Scotland today Pictland instead. So there we go, that's the end of the Picts. A fascinating story, and a very mysterious story as well, where the origins of the Picts is very hazy. But we do get some nice stories of different kings of that era who were gallivanting around the countryside looking for the odd battle or skirmish here and there. So a very interesting period in British history and a very interesting period of Scottish history. And there's plenty of stuff out there that you can find out about the Picts and the Scots, the Northumbrians who were Angles, and the Viking invasions of the British Isles are always fascinating. So a great episode choice by Nick Barksdale of the study of it's the study of antiquity and the Middle Ages, and it's a YouTube channel by Nick Barksdale, and Nick has supported the History of the World podcast for some time now, for well over a year, I believe. And Nick, this is my gift to you. So I hope you enjoyed it, and thank you very much for all of your support. Now, if you do want to support the podcast, we do give out rewards. This is a reward for accumulative contributions towards the podcast. So it has been earned, and you can to earn things such as gift packs, you can earn commissioned episodes just by becoming a patron of the podcast. Now, how you do that, you just go to the History of the World podcast.com website, and you just click on the Patreon link, and it will just take you to the web pages for the History of the World podcast, and you can decide to contribute as much or as little as you like. So even from $1 a month you can donate, and believe me, all of those $1 contributions, they soon add up into something significant. And you know, you've quite likely, those of you who are $1 contributors, you've quite likely contributed towards some of the reading material that I'm using now for these podcasts, especially for the upcoming Rome podcast. So thank you so much, and for all of you who cannot donate, it's a tough time for many of you, and the luxury of this podcast being free is not something that I wish to downplay. It's great that it's free, and otherwise, if you can't make a financial contribution, then don't forget to rate and review the podcast, because that itself has a great value to it, so you will be helping the podcast out. Now, when you do become a contributor to the History of the World podcast, you gain recognition by becoming a member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, and we have a new member this week. I'd like to welcome Brad Massey into the History of the World podcast Illuminati. Thank you, Brad, and your name will go on the Illuminati page on the website. Rest assured, in the coming weeks, your name will appear there. So thank you very much, Brad, and you are now a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati. Now, don't forget to send your messages in. I'm very interested to hear what you thought of the special episodes. I'm very interested. We normally do unscripted episodes, but these ones are scripted and they've been presented in the fullest fashion possible to honour those patrons who have made significant contributions towards the podcast, towards the upkeep of the podcast. And if you do email in, I will endeavour to read your message out, and also anyone that reviews, if I pick up your review, I'll always read that out as well. Now, I'm hoping next week we're going to get stuck into the first part of our Roman expedition. Now, we're going to be looking at Rome for some months. I must admit, such is the longevity of the story. But hopefully next week we'll be kicking that off. So until next week, thank you so much for listening. And don't forget, especially at this time, to be as good as possible. Do you want more from the History of the World podcast? Then visit our website, historyoftheworldpodcast.com. You can join our discussion forum and find us on social media. Support the podcast for as little as $1 per month by clicking the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. The best ones will be read out. Be sure to rate and review the show wherever you listen to us.